Guten Tag. Bezos Hashem. We have actually two events coming up this week. We have Pesach Sheni, we have Lag BaOmer, and I'm going to do something perhaps strange. I'd like to talk a little bit, address Lag BaOmer a little bit, just because it's appropriate and it makes sense. While the truth is that I'm not really equipped to do that, and I'll explain what I mean. Lag BaOmer is something of an anomaly. What exactly is the significance of the day of Lag BaOmer? We seem to see two different themes. There's a lot of obscurity about it. When you just open up a Shulchan Aruch, you see there that the idea is that that was the day that the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. And that's something in itself has to be explained because everybody died, so we're celebrating that nobody else died. That okay, we'll have to discuss that. And then of course the other track, which probably gets much more attention in the public arena, is the Hilul of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Now it's one of those interesting things where in if we'll call it in Litvish circles, there's very little. It's hard to really find much about it, and you certainly have to move more into the realm of Soid. By the Hasidic circles, it's certainly much more developed, the whole Indian. And that's why I'm saying I'm not really equipped to talk about it because I'm not really in that. Nevertheless, what I'd like to do is to perhaps approach it, talk it from a bit more of a Litvish standpoint, if you will, and just try to connect to the significance of it on a basic level in that sense, with the understanding that if you really want the full effect of it, you're gonna have to seek by those who are taka schooled in it. So if we'll start with the
24,000 died.
oh, okay, so let's see.
Dark side is, you know, we're not the symptoms.
So let's see. So already we see in the Ramah that the way he frames it, again, there's obviously a lot more going on that they'll connect it to, is that it's like not a very big deal. Now, but what is the understanding here? So if you just want to approach it on a simple level, there's actually a solemn message being conveyed here, which also fits into the context of preparation for Kabbalah Sotera. What is the significance of what happened to Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva? And again, I'm not that we discussed a little bit last week. I'm kind of approaching it from different angles, not actually hitting the heart of the issue. Now, specifically doing that to discuss why they deserved such a punishment is over my head. But what I am trying to do is approach some of the various points that are being made to us. Last week we discussed the covenant element. And now I want to point out something else, and that is how is it stated in the Gemara? The way it's stated in the Gemara is that all these thousands of Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva died, and then the lashon of the Gemara is Vaya, the world was desolate. Ad Akiva convened a group of five new Talmidim. Again, exactly what happened, I don't know exactly, but again, if you're just looking at the tone of the Gemara, is that he had a yeshiva of 24,000, and by and large, they died out. And he went and he opened the doors of the yeshiva anew with a group of five Talmidim. And it says, Ha'olam shamin, the world was desolate until he convened this group of five Talmidim, and from there, the transmission of the Torah was resumed. Okay. So, in other words, again, if we're not getting into all the details of exactly what happens there's one point that's coming across, and that is to appreciate the significance of the transmission through the Chachamim throughout the generations. Meaning, a person approaching it at first glance could say, the Torah is available, people can come and learn it. But no, Rabbi Akiva went down as one of the very, very great, what we call Moisrei HaTorah, one of the great links in the chain of the transmission of the Torah. And the celebration of this day, you're right, we're not celebrating the fact, oh wow, all 24,000 died and now. But we're celebrating the survival of the Maseiros, of the transmission, of the chain of the Chachamim, who brought it from generation to generation, from the time of Har Sinai all the way down to our times, which is really bringing to mind our understanding of the critical role that that plays in Torah. It's not just that the Torah was given at Har Sinai, now it's available to all. And wherever you approach it from, wherever, it's available to all. It's true. But there's a big added piece, and that is it was given at Har Sinai. From then, it was given over in a live way by the Chachamim of each dar to the Chachamim of the next dar. And that is a critical piece in accessing Torah. A critical piece in accessing Torah is appreciating the idea of the live transmission, appreciating how the survival of Torah doesn't just work by the text being there and available, but it works through a body of Chachamim who are passing it on from one generation to the next generation, and that is the way Hashem set it up. Hashem deliberately wanted it set up that way. In fact, as we'll discuss, Hashem actually made the Torah in and of itself inaccessible. If you don't have the what we call the accompaniment of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the accompaniment of the Perush of the Chachamim who are handing it over orally. Simple examples. Everybody's familiar with this. The word tefillin, what did tefillin look like? Everybody knows what tefillin look like. The square boxes that are black. If you look in the Torah, there's no allusion to what tefillin look like. It's something that you put on the head, between your eyes, and on your arm. What is that something? What is its shape? What is its color? What's it about? What are toitofos? What are toitofos? It's an obscure word. I don't even know what the translation is. And yet the Chachamim come along with Torah Sheba'al Peh and tell us that it's meant to be square, it's meant to be black, exactly what it's meant to be made out of, etc. There are other examples. The Arba Minim. The Arba Minim are described in very obscure terms. Particularly, right? The Aravos is pretty clear. Arve Nach, willows of a creek, that's pretty clear. But pretty much all the others are rather not clear. Pri Eitz Hadar. In a broader way, that translates as a beautiful fruit of a tree. It can translate as Hadar is a description of a type of fruit that survives from one season to the next. Hadar b'ilanai. It can translate, today we translate Hadar as citrus fruits. Whatever it is, the Esrog is not named. And yet, it's very, very clear. Everybody knows that we're talking about the Esrog.
I remember reading, I think, in Mishpahah, some Jew in the middle of nowhere who gets the Torah and decides he wants to start keeping the mitzvahs. So I think he used a pineapple
A pineapple.
instead of the
Beautiful
because
fruit. It's a beautiful fruit. There you go. There you go.
trying to figure it out on his own. Is that
Trying to
not?
figure it out. What's that? I guess he didn't know that either. Okay. Right.
Or a mango. I don't remember, but it was something really exotic,
Something.
you know.
Okay, there you go. Another, look at what, how would the Hadassim describe? Enough eights of us. A braided branch. This can mean a million things. And once again, Hashem deliberately set it up such that you need the perush, the elaboration of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, in order to be able to access Torah. In fact, what is the term for a person? What's the basic term for a person who is a Torah scholar? Basic term? Talmid Chacham. What does the word Talmid Chacham mean? The word Talmud.
A learned person.
What's that? That's not
Student.
the
Smart
literal
student. Smart.
translation. Close. A Talmud of a Chacham doesn't mean a Talmud who's smart. It means Talmid Chacham, the
Talmid.
Talmid of a Chacham. The way we say a scholar is the disciple of the sage. The scholar, by definition, is a disciple of a Rebbe. A person who is not a disciple of a Rebbe, a person who's not getting it from the transmission, doesn't make the grade of a Torah scholar. He can be very learned.
Okay,
Question.
I have to reiterate it just because this is the first time I heard it, because my mother also said that her father was a Talmid of the Rav, okay, one of the was. Okay, anyway, cool. Yeah, some of the Rav. But anyway, so she says, you don't understand. You think Talmid is Talmidim. Explain this to me. No, he was one of 10 of a minion of the Rav.
Oh.
You know, and followed wherever he was and took whatever. So a Talmud is this is only the, you're the first person I hear that, oh yeah, should not.
There you go. There you go. You were going to say something? You were going to
But
say
people
something?
that learn the
What
Kollel,
else?
all the younger life are learning Kollel, they don't have a Rav there. They're all sitting and learning the Kabbalists themselves, and there's no official Rav.
Well, in many cases there is, but if it wasn't there, then they had it in yeshiva. But whatever the case is, it can be
Yes, some
expanded a
people think.
bit to the sfarim that are written by people of our dar. Yet, nevertheless, whether they have a Rebbe with them on a day-to-day basis, whether they're under the broad tutelage of the Talmid Chachamim of the time, pretty much that's the way it works.
But it's also because some of the
That's
there's
right.
some people that they look up to and who they can turn to.
Yes.
What would have screwed in Talmud about coming them because they follow the Rebbe like
That's another manifestation of this idea. That's another manifestation of this idea. Now let's see how it goes. Even it goes quite how far it goes. We'll go from a couple of different angles. Moshe Rabbeinu, his successor was obviously going to be the epitome of the person who's capable of giving over Torah. What was the great qualification of Yeshua? The great qualification of Yeshua, the Gemara tells us, not that he was the wisest of the Bnei Yisrael at the time. It's quite likely that the children of Aaron were greater, that Nadav Avihu, might sound surprising, that may have been greater than him in terms of the wisdom. But his great qualification was the fact that he was the Talmid who clung to Moshe Rabbeinu and was just soaking up from the originator of the Masorah. I want to note a bit more the way Hashem, how this is set up. The, like we said, Hashem, sometimes, you see some aspect of Torah Shebaal Peh. We just showed a couple of examples where you see that really the Torah in and of itself, the Torah Shebitzav, is incomprehensible. There are other examples. It says that Mi'ol Maltem es Arloso. You should circumcise, should mal the Arlo, the foreskin. Doesn't say where on the body that is. Yet there's no dispute exactly what the Mila is, even though there could have been other possibilities, maybe the earlobe, the other place you can cut off the body without it being such a big deal, maybe a little of the skin on the elbow, I don't know. But no, absolutely no question about what it is, once again, because this is the Perush that was given over live, orally, Torah Shebaal Peh. We can go on and on with more examples. We won't right now, but you get the idea. Hashem actually set the Torah up such that it's not really accessible unless you have that added oral perush. And I'll show this from two other angles. The way Rav Hirsch says it is, he also talks about this, and his definition is, he says that Torah, Shebiksav, was not really meant to be a sefer upon which you can build your Yiddishkeit. His mashal is, he says, imagine if there's a major medical conference. If there's a major medical conference and they have the top specialists in all the different fields who are giving their lectures, one person is there and he's taking shorthand notes the whole conference. He has a notebook full of shorthand notes. So he's been there for week, 2 weeks, whatever it is. And then you have his neighbor says, look at the poor loser. He was there for a week, for 2 weeks. I'm going to take his notebook, read through the whole thing in an hour and a half, and I got it all. So no, the shorthand notes are only helpful for the person who was there and heard the whole thing. Then he can refer to the shorthand notes in order to be able to maintain it. That's what Rav Hirsch says is Teresh HaBikshav in relation to Teresh HaBaalpeh. Teresh HaBaalpeh is the full picture. Teresh HaBikshav are notes that help you keep it anchored in those notes. And the Kuzari really lays out how the process works. Hashem gave over this Torah. What is Teresh HaBaalpeh? And sometimes you look at like different drushes of the Chachamim and it's like, come on, does it really mean this, etc. So the Kuzari makes fun of her. He says, like the Karaites, right? They went back to that very good sounding idea of what do you mean? You look at the Torah, you do what it says, right? So he makes fun of how they themselves have to resort to the Perush of the Chachamim when it comes to mitzvahs. He just can't make sense of. He says they do Milah just like we do. They're tefillin just like ours does. Just wherever they could, so they'll deviate from what the Chachamim said, and therefore, yeah, they'll wear the tefillin between their eyes and not up on the head. Okay. But what he says is as follows. He says, again, Hashem gave over this Torah, which is in, we'll call it shorthand form. And in the Midbar, what was the Dor HaMidbar? The Dor HaMidbar, we've already discussed a few times, and it has to be properly understood. But the Dor HaMidbar was the greatest yeshiva that ever existed. Well, the greatest kollel that ever existed. There was never again such a thing where you had the entire Jewish people for such a long period of time concentrated in such a small area, basically in one neighborhood. The entire Jewish people. It was never again such a thing in history. Everybody was concentrated in one neighborhood, and everybody was busy with one thing for those 40 years. They were studying Torah. They were studying Torah. Now let's note a few other things about the Mishnah. So first of all, it brought all the minds of Klal Yisrael together, all in the same place. Number two, there was another very unique aspect about that period that was never again repeated. And that is that Moshe Rabbeinu was the Rosh Yeshiva, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was the Rosh Yeshiva. Who was the, you know, if you know, familiar with the yeshiva structure, is what they call the Meshiv, the Shoyel Meshiv. That is the Rav whose job definition is being the Beis Medrash to answer questions. Okay? It's not the same as the Rosh Yeshiva, it's not the same as the Magid Shir, it's not the same as the Mashgiach. This is a very specific role. Be in the Beis Medrash to field the questions that come up. Everybody who comes up with a lack of clarity, they know, they go over to him, and he's there to address the questions.
But he's more knowledgeable than the Rosh Yeshiva.
Not necessarily, not necessarily. It's
More
different
accessible.
roles. It's different roles. Yeah, more accessible. Now, who was the Meshiv in this Beis Medrash? Moshe Rabbeinu was the Rosh Yeshiva. He was giving over Torah. He was doing a lot of the answering also. But who was the Meshiv? No, not Yeshua. I'll give you a hint. It wasn't the person. Hashem. In those great days, in the very specific period of the Midbar, questions were brought to Moshe. But questions that Moshe didn't have an answer for, questions that couldn't be resolved, were brought back to Hashem. That Moshe, right, that's how Moshe described it, part of when he's describing his role to Yisrael, that's what he described. You know, I go to Hashem with the questions that are unclear. You know, everybody's familiar with the halacha that kicked in immediately once they entered Eretz Yisrael. There's no such thing anymore. From the time they entered Eretz Yisrael, you cannot bring halacha questions back to Hashem. Halacha questions have to be determined by the body of the Chachamim. Has to go through the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin will vote on it. They'll deliberate. They'll debate. Then they'll vote. And that's what the halacha is. But in those days, answers, unresolvable queries were being answered by Hashem. Why? This was a very unique period, which was a very formative period in Klal Yisrael. Basically, what happened was they took this text, the Torah that was given from Sinai, and you had 600,000 strong were sitting and applying themselves to it, breaking it down, plowing it, to the breadth and depth, such that by the time they entered Eretz Yisrael, every aspect of Torah had been clarified and was ready to be rolled out. You take the Torah as is, you can't, like we were just discussing, you can't roll it out as is. But here, over a period of 40 years, the Torah was being very, very intensely processed by the most intelligent of people. And they were breaking it down and analyzing every last crumb of the word of Hashem. Questions were being debated. Whatever couldn't be resolved was taken back to Hashem, such that by the time they entered Eretz Yisrael, they were entering Eretz Yisrael with the Torah Shebiksav, but with also the whole body of study of those 40 years, which was the basis of Torah Shebaal Peh. That's what Torah Shebaal Peh is. Don't think that it was just, oh, Torah was given at Har Sinai, and along with it came this Perush that was handed over just as is, and everybody memorized it. Torah Shebaal Peh was the effect of those very, very rigorous 40 years that were never repeated again in history.
About this, like I don't have any vision of the base midrash in the middle of the midbar. Like they don't talk about it at all. Why not?
Yeah,
Are
many of.
people sitting learning in the middle of the midbar?
That's right.
But they really do say that the people were free to learn
That's
because
right.
all of their needs were
All
taken
their needs were
care of
taken
them.
care of.
So maybe that's what
It's
they need.
that's right. It's between the lines. Many of the rea much of the reality of what was actually going on in those days, Psukim, as we know, and as we're actually discussing now, are sparse. They give you a very basic and sketchy picture of what was going on, and you need a lot of filling between the lines from, as we're discussing now, Torah Shebaal Peh, and then the Rishonim came afterwards and put together the picture. And that's one of the great strengths, I allow myself to say it that way, of the Kuzari, how he actually painted a picture of the reality of the time by putting together all the different between the line pieces. So this is what Torah Shebaal Peh is. That's the body of Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh was that very, very rigorous system of the study that they carried with them into Eretz Yisrael. And this was something that Hashem set up should be given over and debated and moved on from one generation to the next generation through the whole body of Lev Chachamim to the next body of Lev Chachamim.
They say emotion at Sinai, something like that. Is that what this is coming from?
Halacha
Emotion.
L'moshe Mesina.
They say that. Is that what they mean?
That's a part of it. There were certain things that were simply as understood, given over by Hashem to Moshe, not necessarily the part of this process, but this was a big part of that. Yeah.
That's the call for it. How that's the whole time for the really special
It was a very special time.
time.
That's right.
But inside of the Navi,
That's in the Navi.
doesn't show that that was the best, like
Right.
Hashem, like what we're trying to get back to,
That's right. Now it's
and
confusing because when we just read the Psukim, it looks like the Dara Midbar were a generation of troublemakers, one thing after the next.
we all,
Now we've discussed this. Now we've discussed this. We've discussed this in the past. I'm not going to get into the whole discussion now, but we already see in the Gemara them debating. And the conclusion of the Gemara is, like Rabbi Yochanan saying, that they were a Dor Shel Chasidim. But again, as we've discussed often here, the word of the Navi is always going to be extremely harsh and extremely critical. And the greater the people, the greater, the harsher, and the more critical the Navi will be. But again, that's not our discussion now. We've discussed that. Okay. So now, we'll even note another thing. Then Hashem comes and says, there's a halacha, for example, which we don't do today anymore because we can't really handle it anymore. But it says, Dvarim she bal peh yata rashi elohim b'ksav, meaning originally the halacha was that written Torah is not allowed to be said orally, meaning it has to be read from the inside, and that oral Torah is not allowed to be put down in writing. Written has to be kept written, oral has to be kept oral. Which,
Read the Torah. Yeah.
what's that?
You read the Torah on Shabbos.
No, meaning you have to read it from inside. This is actually halacha lemaaseh. You are
Oh.
not allowed to have kriyas haTorah baal peh,
Oh.
right? Any quoting, any recitation of Torah Shebiksav has to be from a script. It's not allowed to be baal peh. And the other side of the coin is, what's that?
Are there today, whether it's Shia who are strict on that, even in the midst of a Shia, in the midst of a.
No, there's a lot of qualifications, meaning the place can discuss. So it's that should be essentially not let us say Kriya Shema by heart. You have to read it from inside. There's a lot of parameters. The bottom line, the way we approach it is that it means when you're being mitzi people. That's how the Gro explains it. When you're actually fulfilling a mitzvah through a medium of Tereshit B'Ksav, it has to be read from the inside. And that's why there's never such a thing as Kiddush is a whole discussion, right? Are you allowed to say Kiddush by heart? Okay, but Kriyas HaTorah will be the classic example. But the other side of the coin is oral Torah is not allowed to be transcribed. Now that, what do you mean? This essentially means that Gemara should not be in Sfarim. That's what it essentially means. In earlier times, that was the way it worked. Meaning, sometimes, people, when the discussion of translations of the Gemara come up, right? And that it's so sometimes I'll say, okay, we can discuss the merit of translations, but let's realize that in terms of taking it a step down, the transition from everything by heart to having a written Gemara was a much more drastic change. Now they did that at that time. In earlier times, throughout the days of the Tanaim, there was no such thing. Everything was given over orally. You were not allowed to write things down. And how did it work? So how did people memorize it? You see the rigors of learning in those days. You reviewed something 40 times before you considered yourself as having a handle on it. And then they would do it 100 times. And there was reviewing and reviewing and reviewing going on while at the same time learning new materials and at the same time analyzing it and breaking it down, all without svarim. That was how it worked for a very long time until we reached the point in history, the way the Chachamim say it is. We saw that the capacity was waning. People just wouldn't be able to do this anymore. And therefore, they made what they took a very, they considered a no choice kind of step and said, okay, we do have to transcribe Mishnah. We do have to transcribe Gemara. It was considered a step down due to the deterioration of the abilities of the spiritual capacities of the generation. And they applied the pasuk that says, Eis lasu yis la'Hashem efiru Torasecha. In order to protect Torah, we had to actually, to a certain extent, violate a certain principle of Torah. Now, part of the idea of this, we also see in the Mefarshim, is the same point. Hashem wants to ensure that people are learning from Rabbein, that transmission is happening in a live way from generation to generation. And therefore, we don't want it all just being in Sfarim. So again, today we're in a compromised situation as far as this goes. And today, yes, we do get much of our Torah from Sfarim. Much of the transmission happens through the crutch of Sfarim. But nevertheless, to still be able to appreciate that issue of the Hashem's desire that it be given over in a live way. We still have that today in a more watered down kind of way, but it's still there. The appreciation of the fact that we need to be receiving it from the live people who received it from those above them, who really saw, who can give you a live example of the way it's supposed to be lived, a live example of the way it's supposed to play out. And that makes worlds of a difference. And we see another interesting thing, which I'll note, and that is that there was a very interesting little incident, an intriguing incident in the Gemara. Rabbi Gamliel, around the time of the Churban, Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi. The Nasi meant that he was, so to speak, the president, as in the one responsible for the affairs of the Jewish people in a general way. But there was no king, etc. Gamliel was the Nasi. As the Nasi, he also presided over all the gatherings of the Chachamim, of the Yeshiva, etc. And there was a debate that Rabbi Gamliel had. Rabbi Gamliel ruled. There was a debate about a halacha in the halachas of Ma'ariv, davening Ma'ariv. Okay? Rabbi Gamliel gave a ruling. And then somebody asked Rabbi Yeshua was Rabbi Gamliel's colleague. Somebody asked Rabbi Yeshua said something else. He didn't know that Gamliel had said this, right? Yeshua said something else. And basically, I'm skipping the details, but basically what happened was that Gamliel kind of confronted him in the Bais Medrash. And when it turned out that Rabbi Yeshua We'll call the question his authority. So Gamliel left him standing. When you spoke to the Nasi, you stood on your feet. Then he told you to sit down. Gamliel didn't tell him to sit down. Told him to stay on your feet. Anyway, that was kind of his way of penalizing him, if we'll call it that. That caused an uproar, which actually led to the deposition of Gamliel. They came, the yeshiva came and said, we're going to remove Rav Gamliel from his post because that happened. What happens? There's a few very amazing things just to know from this little story. First of all, well, what happened afterwards was that they removed Rav Gamliel from his post. Where did Rav Gamliel go from there? Know where he went from there? It says that the next day, when the yeshiva convened, he was sitting on the bench with everybody else. He didn't leave in protest. He wasn't, you know, he was there with everybody else, with his basic approach being, my position as Nasi was a responsibility. It wasn't something that I viewed as like, it's not about me. As long as I was meant to be doing it, I'm going to conduct it in the way that I see fit. If you're exempting me of that responsibility, I'm happy to join the ranks. That's one amazing thing to note from this story. He was right there with everybody else. And we went through a process. They appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah as the Nasi, and then they ended up, what ended up happening was that Rabbi Gamliel went to Rabbi Yeshua to appease him. Rabbi Yeshua then went back with Rabbi Gamliel and said, let's reinstate him. And they worked out a system, a rotation between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. It's a very beautiful account of how things worked between the Chachamim. But, is there something?
If Gamliel really had no like ego about the thing, so why didn't he disrespect that Yeshua had a different whatever's
Oh.
had a different opinion? Okay, I have mine, you have yours. The truth, but
Oh,
they bring their mind.
to answer that briefly, and this is a discussion in itself, the role of Nasi required the Nasi to impose his authority in a very strong way. He was meant to be now the one, the backbone, the spine of the Jewish people that were falling apart, right, in the time of the Churban. And therefore, basically, the way it was taken was, that was the directive of the Beis HaNavi. Impose your nesius with a high hand in order to keep a strong, the Klal Yisrael in strong hands. Now, the way this was taken was that, and this is exactly the point that we're getting at, that's all true up until when it comes to the transmission of Torah, we have a single authority who's in charge of the affairs of Klal Yisrael and the governing of Klal Yisrael, etc. When it comes to the transmission of the Torah, there is no single authority. That always has to be. The supreme authority is the body of the Chachamim. That's really the point that I was getting at this story. That was really the moral of this story. The moral of this story is that there's nobody who's above the body of the Chacham, the independent body of the Chacham.
The
Ah,
Nazi
that this is the important distinction. The Nasi is meant to be presiding over it, and he's also meant to be the supreme authority in terms of the material affairs and the political affairs of the people. But in terms of implementing Torah, etc., he's meant to be an equal with the rest of the body of the Chacham. And this was what was being brought out. This is what was being brought out through this incident. The supreme authority at the end of the day of Klal Yisrael is not an individual person, as great as he may be. It's the body of the Chachamim. And who is the body of the Chachamim? And this is something, as we know, it's not a matter of pedigree. It's not a matter of standing. It's a matter of personal merit. And that's all. And here's another amazing thing about this little incident. Who were that body of the Chachamim at the time? You had the big names. Gamliel, you had Rabbi Eliezer, that's Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva. He was a little bit the next generation. Yeah, that's right. Rabbi Akiva was a bit the next generation. He was like a little younger than the others. But let's take note of these different people's status. Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus were both extremely wealthy people. They were both, if we'll use contemporary terms, multimillionaires. Rabbi Yeshua was destitute. He was a man without any money. And at the end of the day, he held equal footing and authority in terms of, this is also an amazing thing. I don't know if you can see this anywhere else. Equal footing and authority, wherever wealthy people get their money from. They all got it from the same place.
Where?
Rabbeleze ben Hyrcanus was an heir of a very great fortune. But whatever the case is, Rabbi Yeshua, a very poor man, had equal say. There was no difference in status between him and these very wealthy people. You know, people ask the simple question is, why didn't they just support him? He didn't want that. He didn't want that. That was the reality. The top body of the Chachamim included people who were paupers and people who were multimillionaires, and there was absolutely no difference in their standing.
Both, I still can't picture
How did it work in a general way?
the best tzaddikim who respect each other and so on. How is it that they make a decision? They don't vote. So how does the body
How
decide
does the body
together?
decide? So the truth is, here we have to go back to the way Hashem really set it up, and that is with the system of the Sanhedrin. And this Sanhedrin really carried that Maaser from generation to generation. The system of the Sanhedrin was a vote. It was. You had this, again, the supreme body of Chachamim. You have to appreciate how that worked. The Sanhedrin was 71 Chachamim who were filtered up from all around Klal Yisrael. You had the great sages of the town formed the Beis Din of the town. And then there was the Sanhedrin of the area, and then there was the Sanhedrin of the Shevet. And then from there, the top Chachamim of all these different systems were moved up higher. It was solely on, there were no connections, there was no family ties. It was all based on, from all around Eretz Yisrael, there was this system, the local Beis Din, the city Beis Din, the Shevet Beis Din, the top people, and these people were being, in these systems were being moved up, filtering upward toward the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, what's that?
No,
With no protection. That's right. This was something that was transparent across Klal Yisrael. They were being moved up. The Sanhedrin itself was 71. They had the Sanhedrin of 71, and then before the three rows of 71 of the next in line. Every time someone with the Sanhedrin was nifter, everybody moved one seat over, and then the one at the edge, at the so to speak, the front of the next row, moved into the vacated place. And everyone moved one over, and then they pulled up the next person from the national systems. Questions that came up, if they could be decided by the local Beis Din, they were decided by the local Beis Din. If they couldn't be, they were moved up until they reached the Sanhedrin.
does
The
it mean
Sanhedrin?
it nothing to have this opinion?
Zakenim is another word for they simply understood that as the Sanhedrin. The Zakenim. There's different connotations, right? The Zakenim might also be referring to the specific period of the Shoftim. It depends on the context. But the Zakenim in the time of Moshe constituted the Sanhedrin. They debated. And so, again, whenever you're discussing, if something sounds right, it does sound strange, you have to realize
Wow.
that this is something that was put through this system, was then debated by the 71 top. Again, we're talking about, think about the top names. You have heard of the top names. In any generation, when we're talking about the top names, we're talking about five, six, right? And that's already a lot. So imagine when we're talking about, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Moshe Feinstein, top Polskim, but then 71 of them, okay? And they debated it with a fine-tooth comb, and then they went to vote. And here Hashem said the way it works is their decision is Torah. They did vote. They did vote. They went to vote. And their decision, Hashem says, forget about whether they're right or wrong. That's the way Hashem laid down the halacha. Forget about whether they're right or wrong. Their final decision is my will. I'm telling you in advance, Hashem says. You don't have to figure out. I'm telling you in advance. What they decide is my will. If there's an error, it's for them to deal with, and therefore we have a karbon. We're not saying it's inconceivable. We're saying that there's a special karbon that Sanhedrin brings. If they erred, that's for them to deal with. But in terms of what's Klal Yisrael supposed to do, Hashem says, this is the way I want it
Do they
working.
ever repeal the law because they realize they come out with something and they said, oh, we made a mistake, now we're going to revise
So I
it?
don't know if it ever happened, but we do see the Torah laying down the halacha of what happens when Sanhedrin errs, right? Okay. Now, okay, we're still in mid-sentence, but I think we have to stop here. More to be said, but my point is, just bottom line here is that the celebration of Lag BaOmer in a certain way is celebrating the survival of that system, of the transmission. It's not just about getting the Torah from Sinai, as in the tablets, but then about the live transition. Okay, well, we never, perhaps we'll continue this next week. Okay, we'll continue. Thank you.
Wow.